You're listening to Front Page Sunday from WKMS News. I'm Todd Hatton.
And I'm Chad Lampe. The so-called Stand Your Ground law, cited in the media recently as justification for the killing of Florida teenager Trayvon Martin, is under scrutiny now. Kentucky has a similar law, where essentially someone could use deadly force against a person who is threatening their life. To help shed more light on this law in Kentucky, I'm joined by Commonwealth Attorney Mark Blankenship. He serves Callaway and Marshall counties. Mr. Blankenship, thanks for being here.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
First of all, if you could just explain to me Kentucky's Castle Doctrine, which is essentially the Stand Your Ground law.
Right. The Castle Doctrine, for those historians out there, goes all the way back to the 17th century, and Sir Edward Coke started. That was an English idea that the home is your castle. So when we're home, we're in our castles, and so if in the middle of the day or the night someone is breaking into my home, I do not have to ask them why they're there or warn them. Our law says that is a reasonable apprehension of fear, the fact that someone is in the castle that's not supposed to be there. So I can use deadly force within the home without any sort of warning, without even knowing whether this person intends to use deadly force on me. Now, I would caution any citizen to be as careful as possible before you pull the trigger, to make sure that the person in your home is not someone that has a legal right to be there.
When did Kentucky adopt this Castle Doctrine?
We've had it for a long time. It got improved, I guess you could say, in 2006. They added some language to include not only your home, but an occupied vehicle. So if I'm out in my car and someone is trying to get in my car, it's the same as coming into my home. There's some language in the statute that says if wherever you are, you have a legal right to be there, then you do not have to run and retreat if you're confronted with force. That will not be later held against you that, well, you had an option. You could have just run. You could have left. But if I have a right to be where I am and you're coming at me with deadly force, I don't have to run. I can return deadly force in exchange for deadly force. Now, just because the law allows us to do that doesn't mean as citizens we don't have a duty to each other, you know, the ethics of the situation. And what we don't want to ever do is with these laws that someone couldn't use these laws to kill somebody, like me inviting you over to my home. Nobody knowing that but me and you. And so I've invited you over, and I'm expecting you. But instead of that, I've decided to kill you. We want to have a situation where the facts really justify. Every case has to be looked at. And you don't want to, by going overboard with these laws, create a situation where people abuse them.
Who looks at these cases? Who makes the decision whether or not you can press criminal charges?
It's a combination of a lot of people. I've heard this by my detective and other people that have been around law enforcement a long time. The first police officer on the scene is really the first judge on the scene. So the first one there, as they gather evidence, and then it's looked at with a lot of different eyes. We're taking a case to a grand jury this week where a man was killed. He was along with his girlfriend. And we don't have all the facts yet to sort it all out, but they apparently had a legal right to be there. They'd been invited over to an apartment, and this was an apartment building setting. Something goes a little bit haywire at some point in all this, and the victim and his girlfriend end up going into another section of the building, which is not an apartment. It's just a little area. 1 year ago, I think it was a laundromat or something, but now it's like a little workroom, and it's very small, about like the area we're sitting in here, which is not very large. But they bring weapons for some reason. The girl has a weapon, and the man that gets killed has some kind of a stunt gun or something. And the witnesses, all that we have are the people that were inside there, are making them to be the aggressors. And somehow in all of this, the defendant that was originally charged with murder was able to get the gun away from the female and shoot the male. But in that process, see, the police are looking at it. I'm looking at it as Commonwealth attorney. I've had my Commonwealth detective go look at it. And now we're going to have 12 people on a grand jury look at it. So in all of that, it's being looked at to determine, was this what we refer to as a justified murder. I mean, the guy intentionally killed another human being, which is the definition of murder. But it's justified in certain circumstances. But did he have the right to shoot him? The defendant saying he's unarmed, they're charging him, and he did what he could to save his own life and to save maybe the other people that were in there. And so if the grand jury, when they hear all that, if that's what how they see it, which is sort of the way I see it at this point because I don't have any other witnesses. Even the female has now killed herself to make any sort of case. I needed her, and she had an appointment with my office. And 2 days prior, she kills herself.
It's not always cut and dry in a situation like this.
No.
When you add the vehicle in as a possible dwelling, and if you use deadly force and you use a gun, are you required to have a permit to have that gun with you?
We have the carry permit. You can carry a weapon in our state, but you're to demonstrate a little competence.
So if someone, though, didn't have those permits, but then they were in their vehicle and they used deadly force on someone to protect their vehicle, their property, but they were illegally possessing the gun, how does something like that work out?
That's a really good question. The statute doesn't really address that. I think it would still come down to whether there was a reasonable apprehension of fear. The person that ends up doing the shooting needs to be able to prove that they had a reasonable apprehension of fear for their own life, that they thought something was about to happen. It's imminent, and to defend myself or to defend someone else in the car, I use deadly force. When it's real close like that, it's going to come down to a jury question.
What if it were a fight that could potentially turn deadly, but in a rural area, you know, in the middle of nowhere, and you're on somebody else's property?
You mean like a land between the lakes or something?
Sure, yeah.
People are camping, and they're packing weapons.
Yeah.
Those are probably the most difficult at all.
So
that's sort of like you have in the Martin case. You know, they're out. They're not in a residence. They're not in a car. They're just out on a public sidewalk, and this thing occurs. And that's what makes that case so tough. And you've got the 911 call where he's told not to pursue him. So, you know, here in Kentucky, we'd be saying you didn't have a legal right to be where you were because you were told not to pursue. And now, if I look across, you know, in a public area, in a subdivision or in, say, an apartment building, and I see someone breaking into someone else's home, 911 should be called immediately. But now, as a good citizen or as a good Samaritan, I'm still wanting to help. So I've called 911, but the law, it's going to take a little time for the law to get there. So I go ahead and grab my weapon, and I go over to where this place is. Now, I would be allowed to use deadly force if there is proof, and I can see it, that the person is broken into that home, has deadly force, and they may be getting ready to kill the person that lives there. I would be allowed under Kentucky law to use deadly force to save my neighbor's life.
Do you think all of the focus on the standard ground law is justified based on the Martin case?
No. No, I think that's been sensationalized a little bit. Of course, it's such a tragedy, too, that you know, it breaks people's hearts, all of us, to think about a young man like that gunned down and then he's unarmed. So, you know, we just hate to see that in our country. But then when you throw in the different races, it makes it even more complicated.
I'm assuming that you don't think Kentucky will look again at its standard ground law based on...
We haven't had any kind of case that I can think of that's given us a lot of problem with this. Most of the self-defense things seem to work themselves out along the way.
Commonwealth's Attorney Mark Blankenship, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
American Bar Association President Bill Robinson was in Murray this week as part of Murray State's Harry Lee Waterfield Lecture Series. Robinson touched on an issue facing many states in today's tough economic climate, finding the money to fund state courts when the money just isn't in the budget. Shelley Baskin spoke with Robinson about court funding and what the ABA is trying to do about it.
As far as the state court systems go, where is this underfunding coming from? Is this not being put into the state budgets?
The economy, as we all know, since 2008 has been on a severe downturn, and the demand on legislators for government funding has been great in the face of reduced revenues. So it's understandable that legislators have a difficult time choosing where to allocate state revenues in such a difficult period of economic crisis. Unfortunately, the courts are not being recognized for what they are. The courts, by constitution, are one of three co-equal branches of government and need to be funded as such. Last year alone, in 2011, 42 out of 50 states cut court funding in this country, and not a single state in the United States allocates more than 4% of the annual state operating budget to the courts, and too many states allocate less than 2%. So when the courts are underfunded, they're less able to provide access to justice, and access to justice is critical to our constitutional democracy.
And you mentioned the access to justice, but what specific parts of the courts are being hurt by this?
Court vacancies are being left vacant. Court staffs are cut back. Court clerks are not available to the judges. Six states in the last 2 years have actually closed one day a week, and the courts have only been open in those states 4 days a week. New Hampshire, the Chief Justice closed the courts for an entire year for civil jury trials. In California, where the courts have suffered over $600 million in cuts in the last 4 years, in the fall of 11, 29 out of 63 courtrooms were closed in the San Francisco Bay Area, and 40% of the court personnel were laid off. In New York, on the other coast, on the other side of the country, when Governor Cuomo's administration came in early 2011, his administration immediately cut $170 million out of the court system there, and that's in a state where trial judges had not received an increase in compensation, including no COLA increase, for 12 years. So the courts need to be adequately funded, and when they're not, their ability to provide needed dispute resolution, domestic relations, decision-making, and so on, is significantly compromised, and the quality of life in our representative democracy is qualified and compromised and less and less and less. We do not want an urban spring here. We want access to justice.
You touched on it a little bit, but what kind of changes would an individual notice when the court system's underfunded?
Well, let's take the situation in New York as an example. Since the $170 million in cuts last year that I referenced earlier, the courts have now been required for financial reasons in New York City to close the courts at 4:30 p.m. every day. 4:30, everything stops. At lunchtime, everything closes. People clear out the courthouses. When they come back, they have to go through the metal detectors. There has to be security. And then at the end of the day, let's say a witness is on the witness stand, only 5 or 10 minutes to finish. The witness has come from out of town at expense to the client, but the court says no, 4:30, that witness has to get off the stand because we're clearing out the courtroom. That means that witness from out of town has to stay overnight to testify and finish up the next morning, an extra night in a hotel room, extra meals, penalties for changing the airline arrangements. All that cost has to be borne by the client. It drives up the cost of litigation.
And as the president of the ABA, you have a pretty powerful voice on what should be happening in the courts. What's the ABA doing to stop the underfunding?
We're active on a number of fronts. We are partnering with civic and community and business groups, such as the Chamber of Commerce. I've done a joint op-ed in USA Today with Lisa Ricard of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. We are publishing op-eds and articles in publications all over the country. We are speaking all over the country, as I am doing here. We're getting the word out so that the general public understands and appreciates how serious this crisis really is.
Well, Bill, I thank you for joining me today, and I wish you good luck.
Thank you so much. It's been a privilege.
The full audio of ABA President Bill Robinson's lecture, Justice on a Shoestring, The Real Cost of Underfunded Courts, is available online at news.wkms.org. Severe weather can happen at any time of day, but storms and tornadoes that come at night present unique dangers. Why our region is more vulnerable to nocturnal tornadoes and the challenges forecasters face in warning us when they strike, coming up after the break on Front Page Sunday from WKMS News.
This is Front Page Sunday. I'm Chad Lampe.
And I'm Todd Hatton. When you think of a tornado, you probably picture a towering, twisting cloud formation scouring the landscape and bringing destruction and sometimes death. The reason you can picture it is likely because you've seen one during the day. But what if it's at night and you can't see it? What if you're asleep and unaware it's even there? Officials cite that as one of the reasons seven people died when an EF4 tornado struck Harrisburg, Illinois, February 29th. But how susceptible is our region to nighttime tornadoes in the first place, and how can we prepare for them? For some answers, we have Rick Shanklin on the line. He's the Warning Coordination Meteorologist at Paducah's National Weather Service Forecast Office. Mr. Shanklin, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you. Good to be here.
Is there any difference beyond the obvious between a nocturnal tornado and a daytime one?
No. I mean, the mechanics and all are really the same with the nighttime tornadoes versus the daytime tornadoes. There are a couple different things taking place generally with the nighttime versus the daytime tornadoes, and in some cases that can actually make the nighttime tornado stronger. The daytime tornadoes really feed off of one of the key ingredients, the heat of the day. But the nighttime tornadoes, we have something called a nocturnal or nighttime low-level jet, a maximum of wind that sometimes develops just above the ground level, and that can help spin up stronger tornadoes occasionally at night.
And that's the reason our region seems to be especially vulnerable to these nighttime tornadoes?
Well, there are several things that comes into play to produce the tornadoes more at night here versus the plains. The plains tornadoes, for example, do indeed far more feed off of the daytime heat, and then they kind of miss the element that produces the tornadoes overnight.
What role do the rivers in our region play in that?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question. And, you know, we do occasionally, it's pretty rare, but occasionally we see some direct evidence of their play in the weather. I'll just give you one example. A few years ago, we had lake effect or river effect snow across the region, and actually kind of started at the power plants along the Ohio River, and that condensation that they produced then picked up the colder air moving over the lakes. Some areas in Trigg County received up to 3 inches of snow. But when it comes to thunderstorms, most of the time we think the influence is much less, and not to say that there isn't some, because certainly you have that moisture source that can come into play. But really the dynamics in the atmosphere is what's the main thing to actually spin up a tornado. We have to have the right combination of wind shear, that is winds increasing as you go up into the atmosphere, in speed, and winds turning clockwise as you go up into the atmosphere. And that's really irrelevant to rivers and lakes.
Getting back to nighttime tornadoes, how can people prepare for them?
Well, the absolute number one thing for nighttime tornadoes and preparedness is having a way to get the warning. That is absolutely critical, and that is the reason, or certainly by far the main reason, that people perish at night in tornadoes is they do not ever get the warning because they do not have any device, any method to receive the warning at night. You know, we no doubt have had many people in our region that have died that essentially slept till their death, or at least very few seconds leading up to it. So they didn't have time to respond and go to that safe place in their house because they didn't know that a tornado warning was issued or that there was any tornado threat. People are twice as likely to be killed in tornadoes that occur at night, 2.5 times likely to be killed in tornadoes that occur between midnight and 6 a.m. And that's no different for our region. The 47 tornado fatalities we've had right here in our region in the last little over a decade, 42 of those 47 occurred at night, and many of those after midnight. Harrisburg, the most recent example, unfortunately. So you got to have a way to get the warnings. The number one way to do that is weather radios. The second best way to be alerted, another great way, is cell phones. And most everybody has a cell phone now. And the government's actually getting involved in that. Later this year, everybody that has at least the smartphones, newer phones, will automatically get tornado warnings over their cell phone anytime a warning is issued for their area.
Hmm. Well, I'd like to talk a little bit more about warnings themselves. The National Weather Service has rolled out a new initiative in Kansas and in Missouri that uses some pretty stark language in their warnings. Things like mass devastation is likely, making the area unrecognizable to survivors, and this storm is unsurvivable. Now, people who live in a tornado-prone area, like ours, may become desensitized to the normal warnings, or they will hear them and think that they can ride these storms out like they have in the past. Do you think these impact-based warnings are really going to overcome that?
Well, you know, that's certainly what you outlined there. Certainly is a concern that we have, but our greatest concern is the fact that in these high-end tornadoes, that is where we're losing most people. You know, the southeast United States, which is where we lost most people in tornadoes last year, Alabama, Mississippi, in that area. And then second to that is the Joplin, which is where we lost the most people in a single tornado last year. And what we found, and we've worked closely with social scientists in this, is trying to adequately and most accurately relay to the people how serious the threat is. And that is basically where that high-impact language that you just alluded to came from. And, you know, the thing is, the vast majority of tornado warnings will be, as we see them now, that really strong language will only be for those high-end type of events. It could be something, you know, that like the Harrisburg-type tornado, we could have used language in that. Unfortunately, that tornado did not hit anywhere that we had any, you know, strong confirmation of the extent of the damage it was doing prior to that.
I'm curious, have we been overwarning people in the past?
Well, when it comes to tornado warnings, it's a very challenging endeavor, really, because essentially what happens with a circulation that becomes a tornado, it typically develops about 2 to 3 miles up in the thunderstorm. You have that spin, and it gradually works its way down. And at some point in there, we are going to pull the trigger and issue the tornado warning if we see it's strong enough and it's progressively making its way toward the ground. That's when we issue the tornado warning. Fortunately, for people's safety, many times it doesn't quite make it to the ground. Unfortunately, we're not good enough to know when it's going to get, say, to 1,000 feet above the ground and when it's going to make it all the way to the ground. And that is where the dilemma of the excessive tornado warnings are. But the thing to remember, too, is, you know, yeah, it may not make it to the ground, but if a tornado warning is issued, you are in a serious threat, even though it, fortunately, about 80% of the time does not make it to you.
So better to err on the side of caution.
Absolutely.
Well, presumably, graphic warnings like we've just talked about weren't used in the recent storms and tornadoes in Dallas, Texas. But despite all the damage they had down there, they didn't have any fatalities. What did they do right? And is there anything we can learn from them?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, in listening to some of the stories, there were a lot of people that took the correct action. And the reason they took the correct action is they had been educated to that effect, but they had got the warning through a weather radio or somebody calling them, which is another great thing, especially as a backup method to get warnings, is always call relatives, friends, neighbors, et cetera. In contrast to the nighttime tornadoes, when many people do not know there's a threat, therefore they do not take action.
Rick Shanklin is the Warning Coordination Meteorologist at the National Weather Service Forecast Office in Paducah. Mr. Shanklin, thanks for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
Kentucky's lawmakers were in veto recess this week, where the governor looks over proposed legislation and then either signs or vetoes. Kentucky Public Radio's Capitol Bureau Chief Kenny Colston speaks with Rick Hallett about what happens during this recess week and what's ahead for the state budget.
Well, it's been a quiet veto week, hasn't it? We haven't heard much out of the governor.
Yeah, it's been very quiet. I don't know if it's a combination of basketball early in the week and now later in the week we're around Easter time, but it's been very quiet. He's signed maybe 6 or 7 bills, smaller issues that aren't really controversial. And I expect that means that next week we're going to see a very busy week. That veto pen will probably get a workout, especially in the budget bills.
Let's talk about some of the bills that have been passed or that or have not been passed. The auto incentives bill, what is that and what's going on with it?
Well, that bill the governor signed on, I believe, yesterday. And basically what it does is it provides millions of dollars to auto companies that meet certain thresholds. You have to have 1,000 employees, you have to be in business in Kentucky for 5 years, and you have to be willing to invest $100 million in your Kentucky businesses. So basically, it's a wide program, but it's a small one at the same time. This is what led Ford to invest in these Louisville plants, both their plants to help them retool, to help them hire shifts again, you know, second and third shifts. And now this law allows that to happen for Toyota, for General Motors, and two of the biggest suppliers, auto suppliers here in Kentucky. Toyota is really a big fan of this. They can do this tomorrow if they want to. They say it makes them competitive internally. If Toyota wants to build a new plant in the United States, Kentucky would obviously, if they built that plant, that would qualify for these incentives. If they want to start a new car line, they can do it here in Kentucky to get these incentives. And so everyone seems to be rallying around this, and it's a really kind of a slam dunk proposal.
Now, early on in the session, there was a big push for the creation of charter schools, lots of advertising. That bill appeared to be dead for a while, but where is it now?
Well, it seemed that it was going to, there was a deal on the table for a pilot project, something like 20 charter schools statewide in the last few days. But when they tried to attach that bill to another bill that House Education Chairman Carl Rawlins had, he got a little frustrated and upset and declared both of those issues dead on arrival. And in the last day, you know, obviously there's negotiating to get bills out of both chambers. And so basically that charter school amendment on one of Rawlins' bills was taken off of it so that the Senate could get one of their education bills through the House. So basically supporters are saying it's dead for this legislative session since there's only one day left, but they promise they're going to come back in 2013 even harder than they did this year.
And what about there was a bill for Cole County scholarships. What's that about?
That one might be in trouble. I mean, there seemed to be an agreement on the table for this bill to get out as part of budget negotiations. It was originally, you know, we were talking about the University of Pikeville becoming a state school. That didn't work. So they created this scholarship program for 12 to 16 far eastern Kentucky counties. And that seemed to be okay. They would pay coal severance tax money. But in budget negotiations, the Senate changed that a little bit. And from there, what they've done is they've expanded to all coal mining or coal producing counties. That's 38 counties in all. You're talking about eastern Kentucky, western Kentucky. That was part of the budget negotiations. And then suddenly, on the last day, last Friday, that bill does not pop out of the Senate like it's supposed to, like everybody planned on it. The Senate says it just got lost in the shuffle, but there's a little concern on the House side that that bill's either being held hostage or could die once again this coming up Thursday.
You've done some political reporting. You've had a chance to catch your breath a little bit from all the legislative activities, and you've been talking a little bit about the 4th District primary. This is the 4th District congressional race.
That's right, yeah, which actually now, you know, is kind of like a cap on the state. I mean, it already was, but now it shoots all the way in eastern Jefferson County, all the way down to Spencer, and then it goes all the way to Ashland on the whole other side of the state. And so this primary has, you know, a bunch of Republicans in it. That's really where the race is. It's a Republican district. And these Republicans have finally started going after each other. I guess they realize the spotlight's on them. Gary Moore, who's the Boone County Judge Executive in Northern Kentucky, accused state lawmaker Alicia Webb Edgington, who's also running for that seat. She missed the budget votes, and Moore says that she was in D.C. fundraising, she was in Shelbyville fundraising, and that's really kind of, I guess you're not doing your responsibilities as state lawmaker if you're not there to vote on the one bill that you're required by law to vote on. Of course, Alicia Webb Edgington's campaign has said we're going to file those votes when we get back. We're going to vote no. They won't change the outcome, so they're not that important. And so they're battling back and forth. Thomas Massie, who is seen as the Tea Party guy in that race, has picked up a few endorsements. He's in forums. He's throwing a few punches. So these Republicans are starting to get at each other's throats. And I assume that the rhetoric will just increase more and more as we get to May 22nd.
And, of course, the presidential race continues to drone on or heat up, depending on your perspective. But an Obama for America office is now opened in Kentucky.
That's right. And basically, the Obama campaign, you know, make no mistake about it, most people believe Kentucky is a Republican red state when it comes to presidential politics. And I don't feel like the Obama campaign feels any differently, but they say they have a nationwide campaign. They're going to compete in all 50 states, and they say opening a Kentucky office proves that we're going to compete in all 50 states. Say it'll be a statewide office for, you know, not just the Louisville office. It'll serve the whole state. And they even kind of hinted they might open more offices in the future. I'm sure resources and time and how well they're doing in the race all dictates that, but they said you could possibly see Lexington offices or other offices out in the state, which would actually be contributing a lot more resources than people believe the Obama campaign will play here in Kentucky.
Well, one quick legislative question before we let you go. We're in the veto recess. Lawmakers come back to where they can override vetoes. Can they pass any legislation during this time?
Yeah, they actually can, but they don't have any safety over it. So if it's a bill that the governor does not like, you know, obviously he can veto it. That's the concern about the Cole County scholarships we talked about. That's also a concern about the prescription pill bill, House Bill 4 that we've talked about, that they won't have that protection. And lawmakers have gotten really nervous because in the past few cycles they've passed budgets without veto protection, and it makes them really nervous because this governor has shown that he's not afraid to use his veto pen. So any bills that haven't been already passed, even if the governor says he supports them, there's always that chance that they could be amended and he could just take his little red pen and X them out.
All right. Kenny Colston is the Frankfort Bureau Chief for Kentucky Public Radio. Kenny, as always, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You hear Kenny's reports daily during WKMS Newscast, and you can find his online stories at WKMS.org.
The Distinguished Alumni Award is Murray State University's highest accolade for graduates. 50 years ago, the university issued the first of these awards to Jean Graham. That same year, Graham was awarded the Pulitzer Prize and was a Harvard Nieman Fellow. Gary Pitts looks into the life and work of Murray State's first distinguished alumnus.
Jean Graham was born on August 26, 1924 in Murray, Kentucky. He lived in Murray until he joined the U.S. Navy and served as a pilot during World War II. He came back at the end of the war, got married, and started classes at then Murray State College. In 1948, he graduated and started working as a reporter for the Nashville Tennessean.
Jean Graham and I were colleagues.
John Siegenthaler is a former editor and publisher for the Tennessean, a founding editorial director for USA Today, and former president of the American Society of Newspaper Directors. He says he started at the paper a year after Graham, and the two worked there together for more than a decade.
I knew him a long, long time. Was his great admirer, his great friend, his colleague. He was a multi-talented journalist, a first-rate reporter, a wonderful cartoonist, believe it or not, and also a fine editorialist.
And it was as an editorialist that Graham performed his Pulitzer Prize-winning work.
He collaborated with a veteran reporter named Nat Carwell. Nat Carwell and Gene together investigated and reported on a sweetheart deal between John L. Lewis, the head of United Mine Workers, and the owners of the mine company. It was sort of a relationship between management and labor and did not benefit the workers.
The deal between Lewis and mine owner Cyrus Eaton forced layoffs and closures for other mines, many of which Lewis represented. Graham and Caldwell's coverage over 6 years spawned a federal investigation. In the end, the union was found guilty of violating antitrust laws, and both Lewis and Eaton would face numerous lawsuits. Graham and Caldwell landed the 1962 Pulitzer Prize for National Reporting. It was the start of a busy year for Graham. He was awarded the Distinguished Alumni Award from Murray State as alma mater, and he began a Nieman Fellowship at Harvard University. From there, he would go on to become a faculty member in the journalism department at the University of Illinois, Champaign-Urbana.
He was very popular with the students.
That's Dr. Gene Gilmore. He was a colleague of Graham's at Champaign-Urbana. He says Graham was awarded Instructor of the Year honors more than once while there, recognition of his unique ability to relate to his students.
He often had anecdotes that would get across to his students the point that he was trying to make.
Anecdotes like "Kill Your Darlings." John Siegenthaler quotes veteran media executive Alan Mutter.
In so saying, he was arguing for clear reporting and concise writing that puts priority on informing the readers not flaunting rhetorical aerobatics of a self-indulgent writer.
Such philosophies influenced countless future journalists at the University of Illinois, and Graham's reach expanded even further, as he was instrumental in establishing a mass communications program at Middle Tennessee State University. Dr. Ed Kimbrell is the founding chair of MTSU's Department of Mass Communication.
Graham had done a research project throughout all of Middle Tennessee to see if there was a need for such program. And Gene Graham's research was wonderful. Of course, it was beautifully written. And of course, it was the justification that went in to establish a degree in mass communications in 1973.
And like John Siegenthaler, Kimbrell recognizes Graham's talents did not end at being a writer. He worked as a cartoonist for the Tennessean throughout his career. And sitting in his office among accolades for his own successful life's work, one of Kimbrell's most prized possessions is a set of cartoons Graham gave him.
They sit in a place of honor, and it's the first thing a student sees when he or she comes into my room. Just really beautiful work.
Graham spent his final semester teaching journalism at MTSU. A struggle with cancer and brain tumors forced him into retirement. He passed away 30 years ago at the age of 61, but not before his influence spread, immeasurably changing the world of journalism. For WKMS News, I'm Gary Pitts.
When we come back, we'll hear a report on a program in Western Tennessee working to ease the transition into adulthood for kids who've aged out of foster care. This is Front Page Sunday from WKMS News.
This is Front Page Sunday. I'm Chad Lampe.
And I'm Todd Hatton. Approximately 28,000 young people age out of foster care each year in the United States, and many are expected to transition into adulthood instantly, unlike their counterparts raised by parents who are often allowed to ease into adulthood. Many more formerly fostered youth find themselves homeless, incarcerated, or saddled with children at an early age. Youth Villages is a nonprofit that works with young people who've aged out. They operate in 20 states, including work in Paris, Dyersburg, and Clarksville, Tennessee. And as Candace Ludlow reports, Youth Villages is trying to close the gaps through their transitional living program.
Bianca Christian isn't your typical young person aging out of foster care. She scored 25 on the ACT and was headed to college. With the help of her transitional living specialist, Christian chose University of Tennessee, Knoxville. But then in her freshman year, she got pregnant and she didn't know what to do. So she contacted her transitional living specialist.
She helped me a lot with deciding what I wanted to do as far as to move back to Memphis or to stay in Knoxville because there was a big decision.
Now Christian is 20 and studying to be a child psychologist at University of Memphis. She also has a 10-month-old baby boy, and they just moved into their own apartment. Mark Courtney is the lead researcher of the Midwest Study, a longitudinal study that followed 700 former foster care youth from the time they were 17 until 26. He says about a quarter in the study are struggling parents.
In the sense that very few of them have a high school diploma, very few of them have work experience, about three quarters of them are relying on some kind of public assistance. And so they're parenting, but they're doing it under very difficult circumstances. And that's becoming, in many ways, a defining characteristic of their young adulthood.
Kira Baskerville gave birth to Dakarion the summer before her senior year of high school. She's now 19. Kira entered the transitional living program during her senior year. Lydia Dunlap is Kira's transitional living specialist.
So she graduated, and that's kind of where her struggle began with housing. And because when you're not in foster care anymore and you've graduated from high school, those benefits are cut off.
We stop in front of Kiera's great-grandmother's house in Fraser, where she and Dakarion are staying. Dunlap rings her, and she comes out and jumps into the front seat. Earlier in the day, Kiera achieved a major milestone. She signed a lease for her first apartment. Kiera is shy, she's on public assistance, raising a three-year-old, and has been living with various relatives since graduating high school. She says she's been looking for an apartment for about a year. And today is
the best day so far.
Kiera and I usually work in the car because we usually have an errand or something to run, like today's MLGW, turning the lights on, getting the key to her apartment, that sort of thing. And we usually talk in the car about different things that are going on in Kiera's life. Today, one of the things that we are going to address is budgeting skills and kind of talking about what the essentials are for as far as furniture, pots and pans, kitchenware, cleaning supplies, what she needs to start in her very first apartment.
As we start heading toward the utility company, the session begins.
All right, Kira. Now, with your family's first money and your food stamps, how much do you get altogether?
I don't know how much for food stamps yet, but family's first, I get $142 a month. Okay.
So this month, with all of your family's first money and the food stamps that you got $300 this month. Is that correct?
Excuse me.
Okay. So the first thing we're going to talk about is monthly expenses.
After Kira gets her utilities turned on, we head to her new apartment in Whitehaven. Kira says she chose to live in Whitehaven for more opportunity. It's on the bus line, and there are more job prospects. Since 1999, Youth Village's Transitional Living Program has assisted 4,500 young people in the Southeast and Massachusetts. And their outcomes are much better than those in the Midwest study. Most end up living on their own, working, or in school within a year or so. Since I met Kiera, she's secured daycare for her son and is now looking for work. In Memphis, I'm Candace Ledlow.
While Murray State's men's basketball receives national attention, large budgets, and large donations, other sports like the Murray State Rifle Team spend more time under the media radar. But as Drew Adams reports, it hasn't stopped two former riflemen from raising a staggering amount of money in just 2 months.
Kelsey Emmy is a freshman from Piedmont, South Dakota. She's bubbly, outgoing.
Yeah, I don't know what else to say to that.
And she's likely a better shot than you. Emmy is an up-and-coming member of MSU's rifle team, and much like another racer team you may have heard of, she attended this year's NCAA tournament in her sport, competitive shooting. She narrowly missed the finals, landing only 4 points short. But unlike the Murray State basketball team, the rifle team struggles to keep itself funded.
Oh yeah, rifle is a fairly expensive sport.
A collegiate shooter typically competes with their small-bore rifles or air guns, and those can run in excess of $3,500.
There's also like little things, equipment. Sometimes we get a new suit or so, and that's usually about $2,000. Yeah.
To put that in perspective, the average cost to outfit an MSU football player, pads and all, is around $600. And for the rifle team, there is an ever-present need for lead and brass. The rifle team has been funded to cover all its expenses, but in this economy, everyone is looking for ways to boost their coffers. And two former Murray rifle teammates found an almost too-good-to-be-true option. Bill Beard and Ernie Vandizandi, backed by generations of former members, discovered an opportunity through the Scholastic Shooting Trust and the Midway Foundation. These two groups, along with their founders, Larry and Brenda Potterfield, would match donations at an unprecedented level. Scholastic Shooting Trust Director Dick Leeper.
So last year, any school that sent in a donation, the founders would match it 6-1.
So for $100 donated, the organizations added $600. That offer, though, only lasted for 2 months. So Beard and Vandizandi made a list of former members of the Murray State Rifle Team and called each one to inform them of the opportunity. And on it went, every day, for 2 months, Ernie and Bill presented their case to prospective donors. Ernie Vandizandi.
It was a long and cumbersome effort, but a work of love. It was just amazing how many past members of the shooting team had that same feeling that Bill and I did.
As the months progressed, the two began seeing results. $100 check here, $500 there. As the money came in, Beard asked Vandizandi how much they'd finally be able to offer the rifle team.
And I said, well, I don't know. I think we might get maybe a total of $10,000. And Ernie was saying, well, I don't know, if we raise $2,000 more, I think we'll be doing good.
In a few weeks, they blew by both guesses, and the totals kept growing, $15,000, then $20,000, then $30,000. Finally, December 31st came, and the two discovered, in all, 78 former shooters, alums, and even former competitors donated $50,000. When paired with the match, the total staggered Ernie Vandizandi.
We ended up with $343,300. Yeah. We were blown away, believe me, it was great.
This money is a permanent endowed trust in the name of the Murray State Rifle Team. Beard and Vandizandi are still raising money, but even if they never add another dime, rifle coaches will have access to nearly $18,000 per year to keep racers like Kelsey Emmy shooting. For WKMS, I'm Drew Adams.
The Murray State University Classical Guitar Ensemble is fairly new to campus. Last year, the ensemble played its first full concert with the string ensemble, and they'll be doing so again this Tuesday evening. Much of the music from the first concert came from Brazilian composer Maestro Celso Machado, and this year the ensemble will present the United States premiere of Maestro Machado's most recent composition for quartet, Sweet Amazonas. Gary Pitts, a member of the ensemble, reports on the life and works of the composer.
Celso Machado was born in 1953 in the south of Brazil near Sao Paulo. He's the second youngest of five brothers, all of whom are musicians. His father passed away when he was just 3 years old, but he left the family heavily infused with a culture of music.
The music was already there, you know, all day long. Someone was playing some kind of an instrument.
Celso's father was a guitarist, and so were his brothers. His oldest brother learned from their father, and he passed the knowledge on.
Of course, my brother was teaching me guitar. He was teaching mostly, mainly like the Brazilian music, the bossa nova chords and that kind of thing.
Rhythm is an extremely important part of Brazilian music, arguably more so than any other aspect. So along with being wonderful guitarists, Celso and his brothers are also very talented percussionists. He says growing up, they were always banging on something.
Pots and pans and chairs and tables, and that's the way how we make music at home.
So growing up, Machado's home was filled with Brazilian music, but early on, he developed an interest in European classical music. He and his brothers moved often, taking jobs in bands all throughout the country. But wherever they went, he found someone who could teach him the classical style.
And especially for Bach and Vivaldi and Handel and Daland. So I was being very, very fascinated for this music.
In fact, he was so fascinated with it that he decided to move to Europe and immerse himself within the culture. It was there that he composed the suite Danças Populares Brasileiras. It's a set of short pieces for guitar quartet based on Brazilian dances. He says while in Europe, he began to feel homesick, and writing the suite reminded him of home. One piece, Ciranda, is based on a children's dance.
Ciranda is like and the kids holding their hands together and making a circle in turning around and in singing some song, children's songs.
Another part of the suite is a piece called Panteio. It contrasts sharply with Ciranda. It's more dissonant and rhythmically complex. Machado explains Ciranda is more representative of music from the south of Brazil, while Panteio represents the north.
The style of that music it comes from the northeast of Brazil. It's a continuously open D note. It's very typical Brazilian music from the northeast. Sometimes called the repente, you know, they improvise by playing with the open chord.
This semester, the MSU Classical Guitar Ensemble performs Celso Machado's most recent work for guitar quartet, Sweet Amazonas. It's a beautiful, complex, and challenging work that takes the listener through a range of emotions. Maestro Machado says the first and third movements of the suite were written fairly recently, but he started writing the second movement many years ago.
Sometimes that's the way that happened to me. I have a lot of things that I started, like this composition I started 20 years ago. And it's still there, and all of us said, let's do something of that.
Sweet Amazonas will make its U.S. premiere when the MSU Ensemble plays it in concert. Machado says, to his knowledge, its only other performance thus far was in Costa Rica, since that's where he was when he finished it, and he wanted to know what it sounded like. For WKMS News, I'm Gary Pitts.
The combined guitar and string ensemble concert is this Tuesday evening at 7:30 in Murray State's Performing Arts Hall. The guitar ensemble will be playing works from Celso Machado as well as Maurice Ravel and Leo Brower. You've been listening to Front Page Sunday from WKMS News. Our correspondents are Drew Adams, Shelley Baskin, Seth Helton, Casey Northcutt, Gary Pitts, and Rose Kristen Presson. Kate Lochte is a contributing producer, and Matt Markgraf provides website assistance.
If you have questions or comments about the stories you've heard today, you can email us at msu.wkmsnews@murraystate.edu. You can also have your say at our Facebook page, and there's a link to that page at our website, news.wkms.org, where you can also hear any of today's features again. Join us Friday morning at 8:35 for Front Page AM and Friday evening at 6:30 for Front Page PM. Thanks for being with us.